to Aviation Intelligence Weekly with Sarah and Mike, your guide to the aviation industry. Jet A fuel at $8.31 a gallon, airline profits cut in half, and the Strait of Hormuz still closed. That's the world aviation investors woke up to this week, and the stocks said everything about it.
We're talking broad-based selling across nearly every subsector. Airlines, defense primes, engine makers, aerostructures, almost nothing was spared. The week's narrative was a sector-wide repricing of the cost and geopolitical risk that the Hormuz closure has now baked permanently, sorry, durably, into aviation economics.
That's the right word, durably. And this week's narrative was a simultaneous pressure test. Fuel costs hit a year high, IATA's profit-halving forecast got more real by the day, and the market voted with sell orders across the board. We're going to walk through what that means for operators, for investors, and for the specific signals that came out of filings this week.
Plus, a leadership shakeup at a major defense electronics firm that's worth unpacking, a debt move from a cargo giant, and a genuinely interesting divergence between who's holding up and who's cracking.
All of that right now. Let's get into it.
So let me frame the narrative properly, because this week didn't happen in a vacuum. This week's narrative was the aviation sector absorbing a dual shock. The fuel cost environment reaching a new threshold, while the geopolitical architecture that caused it shows no sign of easing.
Operationally, what that means is airlines cannot outrun the cost curve. Even carriers posting strong revenue growth, we're talking double-digit top-line numbers, are watching those gains get consumed by fuel bills. American revised its full-year guidance to a range straddling zero, anywhere from a loss of 65 cents to a profit of 65 cents per share. That's not a precision forecast. That's a company saying we genuinely don't know which side of break-even we land on.
For investors, the read-through is that the sector is bifurcating. Companies with pricing power, fuel hedges, or defense revenue exposure are increasingly separating from pure-play commercial operators who are fully exposed to spot jet fuel.
And that bifurcation is the lens for everything we're going to cover today. The question isn't whether aviation is under pressure. It clearly is. The question is, who has the structural characteristics to survive a fuel environment that could persist well into next year?
Right, and that brings us directly to the primary signal. The most important signal this week came from the airline sector's guidance revisions and capacity adjustments. Not just one carrier, but a coordinated pullback by multiple U.S. network and low-cost carriers simultaneously signaling that fuel at these levels is breaking the earnings model.
Operationally, what that means is H2 capacity cuts are coming, when American, Southwest, and Alaska are all revising guidance downward simultaneously. That's not isolated execution risk. That's a shared cost structure hitting a shared ceiling.
For investors, the implication is straightforward. Revenue growth is no longer sufficient to drive earnings growth in this environment. The sector needs either a fuel catalyst or a demand catalyst to re-rate, and neither is clearly on the horizon right now.
And the TSA data this week actually reinforces that demand picture in a subtle but important way. TSA screened 12.3 million passengers this week. That's down 1.2% year over year and 1.7% below the three-year average.
So demand isn't cratering. People are still flying. But it's softening at the edges. And when you combine modest demand softness with a fuel bill that's up 70% year over year, the margin math gets brutal very quickly.
Let's get into the price action, because the week's moves tell the story sector by sector. Mike, you want to walk us through the damage?
Yeah, and damage is the right word. Across the board, the aviation universe sold off hard. Airlines were the epicenter. United was down over 7% for the week. Alaska was down over 8%. Southwest dropped nearly 7%. JetBlue lost almost 7%. These aren't small moves. These are meaningful valuation resets.
And the common pressure behind this coordinated move was jet fuel at a year high, combined with guidance cuts from multiple carriers in the same week. That's not coincidence in the sense of timing. It's the same macro input hitting every income statement at once.
Exactly. Now, on the defense side, it was rough, but less acute. Defense primes dropped 3 to 5% across the board for the week. Lockheed was down about 5%, Northrop down about 3.5%. What's interesting is Northrop actually had a strong single session midweek, up over 3% on one day, which tells you there's a bid under defense names even in a down week.
That single-day Northrop move is worth noting. The European rearmament story, Sweden ordering Gripen jets, Latvia evaluating light combat platforms, is creating a durable demand signal for defense revenue that the market is starting to price in selectively.
The aerostructures names got hit hard too. VSE Corporation was the week's biggest loser, down over 10% for the week, with a brutal single session that saw it fall nearly 7% in one day. Hexcel dropped almost 9% for the week. Howmet was down 6%.
What matters in the aerostructure sell-off is less about company-specific news and more about what it signals for the supply chain. If the OEM delivery ramp is slower than expected, Boeing targeting a return to the 60s in monthly deliveries, while the FAA ordered inspections on nearly 500 in-service MAX jets, then the suppliers dependent on production volume are exposed to downward volume revisions.
And the FAA inspection order on those Boeing MAX aircraft is a real operational headwind. Airlines that have those jets are looking at potential ground time, which is the last thing you want when your fuel bill is already eating your margins.
On the cargo side, the picture was actually relatively stable. UPS was essentially flat for the week. We're talking fractions of a cent. FedEx was down under 2%. That relative stability against a backdrop of broad aviation selling is a data point worth holding on to.
It tells you cargo economics are partially decoupled from the passenger fuel squeeze right now. And UPS's debt filing this week, which we're going to get into in more detail, adds another layer to that story.
The engine makers and avionics names followed the broader trend, down 5 to 6% for the week across the category. And in eVTOL, the moves were relatively contained. Archer and Joby both down, but in the low single digits for the week, which is interesting given how volatile those names usually are.
What matters is not the individual price moves, it's the pattern. Almost nothing in the aviation universe finished higher this week. The cargo names held up best, defense primes held up better than airlines, and the pure play commercial operators took the most punishment.
That hierarchy is the investor signal. When the market sells a sector broadly, but still differentiates by business model exposure to fuel and geopolitics, it's telling you something about where capital is going to want to be positioned going forward.
And the leasing sector, for what it's worth, was down less than 3%. AerCap held up reasonably well in a tough tape. Which makes sense. If airlines can't get new jets from OEMs and have to keep older ones, lessors with desirable wide-body assets are in a structurally stronger position.
The A350 data we have this week actually reinforces that. New build A350-900 monthly lease rates have firmed to between $900,000 and $1.2 million, supported by the wide-body shortage. When supply is constrained at both OEM and lessor level, the assets that exist become more valuable.
So the market overview this week is essentially broad-based selling, fuel-exposed commercial aviation hit hardest, defense and cargo showing relative resilience, and leasing quietly benefiting from the same supply constraints that are hurting airlines.
That's the map. Now let's get into the signals that explain the territory underneath it.
So let's talk about the UPS debt filing, because I think it's being underread by the market, and it deserves more attention than a cargo name getting essentially flat performance this week would suggest. On August 18th, UPS filed an 8K disclosing a debt transaction executed 4 days earlier, $325 million in floating rate senior notes due 2076. That is a 50-year maturity on floating rate paper. Think about what that combination actually means.
50-year paper is unusual by itself. Floating rate on 50-year paper is a very specific statement. You typically issue floating rate when you believe rates are going to fall, because your coupon adjusts down with the market. So UPS is essentially telling you two things simultaneously. We need capital now, and we think the rate environment improves from here.
Which is an interesting macro bet for a cargo operator to be making in the middle of a geopolitical shock that has elevated fuel costs and compressed margins across the logistics space. The general corporate purposes designation on the use of proceeds is deliberately vague, but the timing is what I keep coming back to.
Right, and I want to push back slightly on the bullish read here, because there's another interpretation. Floating rate at a 50-year tenor also means your interest expense is variable for 5 decades. If rates don't fall the way you're expecting, or if they stay elevated because the geopolitical environment keeps energy prices, and therefore inflation, structurally higher, you've locked in variable cost for 50 years without locking in a rate floor.
That's a fair challenge, but the counterargument is that UPS's relative stock performance this week actually supports the view that the market sees this as a company that has its house in order. Flat on the week, when airlines are down 7 and 8%, when aerostructures are down 9 and 10, that's not nothing. The market is telling you cargo economics are partially insulated from the fuel shock hitting passenger carriers.
The mechanism there is worth explaining, because it's not obvious. Cargo operators have more flexibility on fuel surcharge pass-through than passenger carriers do. When jet fuel goes up, a cargo shipper can adjust the fuel surcharge on a contract with a relatively short notice period. Passenger airlines are selling tickets weeks and months in advance at locked prices. They can't retroactively reprice a seat after the fuel bill arrives.
So the structural difference is contract flexibility. And UPS, by issuing this debt now, may be positioning for capital deployment in a window where cargo demand is actually being supported by the Hormuz disruption. When maritime routes get disrupted, air freight becomes more attractive for time-sensitive goods. That's a real demand tailwind that doesn't show up in the passenger traffic data.
The TSA numbers this week, 12.3 million passengers screened, down 1.2% year over year, don't capture air freight at all. And if you're trying to understand UPS's strategic calculus, you have to think about what a prolonged Hormuz closure does to air cargo volumes and pricing.
Exactly. So the UPS debt filing, read in context, is a company that sees a demand opportunity in the freight market created by the same geopolitical shock that is hammering passenger carriers, and it is raising capital at the moment when its cost of doing so is relatively manageable, given its balance sheet position.
Where I land on this is, watch what they actually deploy the capital toward. General corporate purposes is the placeholder. The strategic reveal comes in the next 1 or 2 quarters, when we see whether this goes toward capacity, toward acquisitions, or toward refinancing higher cost existing debt. The filing tells you the move was made. It doesn't yet tell you the destination.
And that ambiguity is precisely why flat on the week in this environment is the right market reaction. Not euphoric, not punished, held in suspension, pending clarity. The signal is real. The full interpretation is still pending.
Okay, let's pivot to the L3Harris leadership transition, because this one has more immediate analytical meat on it. The 8K filed August 17th was an immediate CEO change, not a planned succession, not a years in the making transition. Sam Mehta, 53 years old, moves from running space and mission systems and communications and spectrum dominance directly to president and CEO in one step on the same day the filing hits.
And the revenue concentration point here is critical. Those two segments that Mehta ran represent approximately 80% of L3Harris's total revenue. So this is not a CEO coming from a peripheral part of the business. This is effectively the operating leader of the core franchise getting the top job.
Which suggests the board was watching this person run the majority of the company and decided continuity of that operating model was the priority. That's a different kind of succession than bringing in an outsider to shake things up.
The compensation structure supports that read. A base salary of $1.25 million, a 200% target cash bonus, and $13.25 million in long-term incentive targets. That long-term incentive number is where I focus, because it creates a multi-year lock-in. Meta's financial interests are now tied to where this stock is 3, 4, 5 years from now, not where it is in the next quarter.
And LHX had a genuinely rough week in the market, down over 4% for the week overall, With a single session that saw it fall 4.6% on August 17th, the same day the CEO filing hit. So the market's initial reaction to this transition was not enthusiastic.
I'd be careful about reading that single session move as a clean referendum on Meta's appointment specifically, though. The entire defense sector sold off that week. Northrop, Lockheed, Kratos, all down. The macro pressure from fuel costs and geopolitical uncertainty doesn't care who the CEO is.
That's true, but the magnitude matters. 4.6% in one session when the sector is broadly down, that's a larger single-day move than most of its peers experienced on their worst day. LHX's worst day was worse than comparable names, which suggests the leadership change was adding uncertainty premium on top of the macro selling.
Or it's the market pricing in that Meta's promotion means his predecessor's strategy gets re-examined. When a CEO changes, investors ask, what was the previous approach? What changes? And is the new leader willing to make the hard calls that the old one wasn't?
And the timing is interesting in the context of the broader defense sector dynamics this week. We have European rearmament accelerating, Sweden ordering Gripen jets, NATO allies increasing defense budgets, and that is creating genuine new demand for the exact capabilities Meta spent the last few years running. Space, mission systems, communications, spectrum dominance, these are precisely the capability categories that NATO allies are asking for right now.
Which means Meta steps into the CEO role at a moment when his operational expertise is arguably more commercially relevant than it has ever been. The question is whether L3Harris's international sales infrastructure is positioned to capture that European demand before competitors do.
The 25-plus years of aerospace and defense experience the filing references, that's not boilerplate. In a sector where customer relationships are often more important than product specs for winning contracts, the CEO's personal network matters enormously.
What I'm watching in the next quarter is whether Meta uses his platform to signal any strategic shifts. International expansion, portfolio rationalization, acquisition appetite. The $13 million long-term incentive package tells you the board wants him thinking in years, not quarters. But the market's going to want some signal on direction sooner than that.
And the Kratos Form 4 this week sits adjacent to the LHX story in an interesting way. Kratos' general counsel sold shares under a pre-planned 10b5-1 arrangement. Routine, scheduled, nothing alarming. But Kratos itself was down nearly 10% for the week, with a single session dropping over 7% on August 20th.
Kratos is a different kind of defense name, more concentrated in autonomous systems and drone technology, less diversified than L3Harris. So the sell-off there tracks with broader defense derating. But the magnitude suggests the market is also repricing the risk premium on smaller, less diversified defense platforms in an uncertain budget environment.
The insider sale at Kratos being pre-planned is actually the reassuring signal there. When the general counsel is selling on a schedule set in March and the stock drops 9% in the same week, the scheduled nature of the sale tells you this wasn't someone reading internal signals and moving ahead of bad news.
That distinction matters a lot. Pre-planned sales are noise relative to the macro signal. The macro signal for defense this week was broad sector pressure, European demand opportunity, creating selective bids on specific names, and leadership transitions at major primes, introducing short-term uncertainty that the market priced in immediately.
So here's what I keep coming back to when I look at this week's full performance table side by side. You have General Dynamics down less than 2% for the week, and you have VSE Corporation down over 10%, and you have Cargo essentially flat. That spread, almost 9 percentage points between the best and worst performers inside a sector that's supposedly all getting hit by the same macro shock, that spread is the story.
And the question that spread forces you to answer is this cyclical positioning or structural differentiation?
Because if it's cyclical, you'd expect mean reversion. The names that held up give background when the macro fear fades, and the names that got crushed bounce back because the selling was indiscriminate. But if it's structural, then the divergence is telling you something durable about which business models survive a prolonged high-fuel, high geopolitical risk environment.
My read is, it's more structural than the cyclical camp wants to admit. General Dynamics holding up at down less than 2%, while Lockheed is down 5% and Kratos is down nearly 10%. That's not random. GD's revenue mix is heavily weighted toward defense systems with long-cycle government contracts, and critically, its Gulfstream business has a backlog that doesn't evaporate because jet fuel spiked. Business aviation buyers are not the same customer as a leisure traveler on a Spirit flight.
I'll push back partially there. GD's relative resilience also has a near-term explanation that's more cyclical in nature. The Form 4 we saw this week from an EVP was a routine equity compensation withholding sale. Nothing alarming. The stock didn't have a company-specific catalyst dragging it down. So, some of GD's outperformance is absence of negative news, rather than presence of positive structural characteristics.
Fair distinction. But absence of negative news in a week, where almost everything had a reason to sell off, is itself a structural statement. If your business model doesn't create incremental bad news in a high fuel cost, geopolitical shock environment, that's a feature.
Where I think the structural case is clearest is actually in the cargo versus passenger airline split. UPS essentially flat. FedEx down under 2%. Meanwhile, United is down over 7%. Alaska is down over 8%. That's not cyclical noise. That's two fundamentally different exposures to the same fuel input.
The pass-through mechanism we talked about earlier. Cargo can reprice. Passenger carriers are stuck with the seats they sold 3 months ago at prices that assumed fuel at a different level.
And the Honeywell move this week adds another wrinkle to the divergence story. Down nearly 6% for the week, the biggest single-day drop coming on August 19th, the same day the HON 8K landed, disclosing the executive transition inside the process automation segment. So you have a conglomerate with aviation and industrial exposure getting hit on both the macro and the leadership uncertainty premium simultaneously.
Which actually makes the Honeywell sell-off look more cyclical than structural to me. The business itself isn't impaired. It's the uncertainty premium from a segment leadership shuffle in a week when the tape was already brutal. That's the kind of thing that reverses when clarity arrives.
So where does that leave the positioning thesis? The base case is that defense primes with diversified revenue and government contract backlogs outperform into year end as European rearmament demand creates a durable bid. But the key risk is a federal budget resolution that compresses domestic defense spending faster than international sales can offset it.
That's the right frame. And investors sitting with that base case need to watch the budget negotiation calendar as carefully as they watch the Hormuz situation, because those are the two variables that determine whether the structural differentiation thesis plays out, or whether the cyclical crowd gets vindicated by a broad sector recovery.
Okay, let's talk about what's coming, because next week is not a quiet week on the calendar, and the data we're going to get has direct implications for almost everything we've discussed this morning. Mike, you want to run the watch list?
Absolutely. First, watch any further airline guidance revision or capacity announcement from the remaining major carriers who haven't yet updated their H2 outlook, because it will confirm or contradict the narrative that the guidance-cutting wave we saw from American Southwest and Alaska this week is sector-wide rather than carrier-specific.
If United and Delta both update their outlooks in the same direction, that's confirmation the fuel math is broken at current prices for the entire network carrier model. If they hold guidance, it suggests some carriers have hedging or revenue structures that are providing meaningful insulation.
Second, watch the FAA's follow-through communication on the Boeing MAX inspection order covering the nearly 500 in-service jets, because it will confirm or contradict the narrative that Boeing's production recovery timeline is going to face regulatory headwinds concurrent with the manufacturing ramp.
That one is critical for the aerostructures and MRO names specifically. VSE's 10% plus decline this week already reflects some of this risk being priced in. But if the FAA inspection findings create grounding orders rather than just inspection requirements, the supply chain impact gets materially worse.
Third, watch any commentary or filing from L3 Harris, whether that's a press release, an investor call, or another 8K, that gives Sam Mehta's first public signal on strategic priorities, because it will confirm or contradict the narrative that this was a continuity succession rather than a strategic pivot.
The market priced in uncertainty on the day of the announcement. The next data point from LHX resets that uncertainty premium in one direction or the other. If Mehta signals continuity and operational execution focus, the stock probably recovers some of that 4.5% single-day drop. If he signals strategic review or portfolio changes, expect more volatility.
And fourth, watch the Hormuz shipping lane developments and any diplomatic movement between the relevant parties, because it will confirm or contradict the entire fuel cost narrative that is the foundation of this week's sector-wide repricing.
That one is the macro override. If there's a credible diplomatic development that puts a timeline on Hormuz reopening, jet fuel prices come off, airline earnings models re-rate upward almost immediately, and the entire divergence we've been discussing compresses. If there's no movement, the structural differentiation thesis has another week to deepen.
And investors should be watching Brent crude alongside the jet fuel spread, because even if Hormuz headlines improve, the crack spread, the premium that jet fuel commands over crude, can stay elevated independently based on refinery capacity constraints. Those are two separate variables that are both moving right now.
That's the watch list. Four items, all interconnected, all capable of materially changing the investment thesis in either direction. Now, let's close this out, because I think there's a synthesis here that's worth stating clearly before we let people go.
I'll take a first pass at it. What this week ultimately told us is that the aviation sector is not a monolith, that the companies with structural insulation, government contract backlogs, fuel surcharge pass-through, wide-body scarcity leverage, are separating from pure commercial operators in a way that looks increasingly durable rather than temporary.
And the filing activity this week reinforced that thesis in ways that don't show up in the price action alone. A cargo giant raising 50-year capital on a floating rate bet about the interest rate environment. A defense electronics firm handing its CEO role to the person who ran 80% of its revenue. A defense manufacturer refreshing its accounting leadership with nearly 20 years of Big Four experience as it tries to restore institutional credibility. These are strategic moves, not reactive ones.
Which brings me to the synthesis. The sector is stressed. The stress is not evenly distributed, and the companies making deliberate long-duration capital and leadership decisions right now are telling you they expect to be operating in a fundamentally different competitive landscape 12 to 36 months from now.
The investor takeaway from this week is one sentence. Stay disciplined about which subsector exposure you're holding, because the macro headwinds are real and durable, but so is the divergence between who survives them and who gets restructured by them.
Well said. That's the week. Thanks everyone for listening to Aviation Intelligence Weekly. We'll be back next week with the next set of signals. And as always, we'll keep watching the filings so you don't have to.
Until then.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All data referenced reflects publicly available information as of the week ending August 23rd, 2026. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Consult a qualified financial professional before making any investment decisions.
Welcome to Aviation Intelligence Weekly with Sarah and Mike, your guide to the aviation industry. Want the inside track on aviation's biggest players? Aviation Intelligence Weekly brings you expert analysis of airline earnings, breaking industry news, and deep dive company histories. From American Airlines to Boeing, we cover the business of flight every week. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.